From Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network, welcome to Cafe Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Joyce Vance.
How are you, Joyce? There's a monsoon happening in the New York area. Even though the sun has come up, has been up for hours, it is like almost pitch black outside. How are you doing?
I'm good. I saw some of the video of that water just spraying off car wheels. How are your subways?
Well, I'm in the Westchester at the moment. I think there's a lot more flooding in New York City than in the suburbs. But I can hear the pitter-patter of rain outside, but the show must go on.
Well, you know, climate change isn't real.
Halloween's coming up. You like that segue? Halloween's coming up.
It was good, yeah. It is coming up. It's coming up on a Sunday, always my least favorite day for Halloween, which is one of my favorite holidays.
Have we had a debate about candy corn?
You know, we haven't, but I'm just going to have to shut you down and say I'm strictly in the anti-candy corn faction.
I think I am also, but I don't feel that strongly about it. I'm one of the few people who doesn't feel that strongly about it.
I'm old enough that I have finally realized, even though it's pretty, it's not worth eating it every year, hoping that just this year it's finally going to taste good, because it never does.
Some people love it. Mm. We have more weighty things to talk about, I think.
It has been a very weighty week, I think.
So we got to talk about the January 6th committee. We got to talk about abortion. And we're also going to talk about the trial of the folks who killed Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia. So let's start with the January 6th committee. So the continuing saga of whether or not Steve Bannon, who has defied the committee subpoena, will be charged criminally continues. There was a committee vote last week, unanimously in favor of making a referral for criminal contempt to the Department of Justice. Then the whole House had to vote on it. The vote was 229-202, with 9 Republicans voting with the Democrats. You surprised by that? Is that about right? Is that what you expected?
No, I confess that I was surprised by that. In normal times, that would have seemed about right. I guess here it really reflected in many ways the number of Republicans who were willing to vote for impeachment, of course, with the addition of one Republican member of Congress who just wanted to make sure that the subpoena would be available to her after 2022 when she wanted to start subpoenaing Democrats.
So, okay, fine. Let's talk about that person. Representative Nancy Mace of South Carolina, who didn't vote for impeachment, didn't vote in favor of the creation of the January 6th Commission. She's a freshman, so a junior congressperson. And by the way, the first woman to graduate from the Citadel. And as you point out, she was very clear, quote, "I want the power to subpoena when we start to investigate some of the crises that are facing the Biden administration right now, from what's happening at the border to Afghanistan," end quote. You know, I don't know, kind of a fair argument, right? Like we talk about this all the time. Be careful what you wish for. Do you want the other side to have the same power? She seems to be one of the few people who, even though she's, you know, not a supporter of the Biden administration, has some feeling about consistency, fair or not.
I think it absolutely is fair. And you're always good to issue the cautionary tale on this one, particularly when it comes to this notion that Congress has the inherent power to enforce contempt. You know, that jail that maybe they're going to build inside of the underneath the Capitol dome could fill up with Democrats pretty quickly.
Isn't it a little bit weird that more Republicans didn't take that point of view and want to maintain the institutional ability to do their own investigations and serve their own subpoenas? Or is politics just so cynical they can vote a particular way now and then next time they can vote a different way, saying, well, you know, Democrats broke precedent or trampled a norm, or I don't know what the argument is.
I mean, are you suggesting maybe that you could say that you would never confirm a Supreme Court candidate in the last year of a presidency, but also that it's okay to confirm one after voting has started in an election? You're not suggesting that level of hypocrisy could exist in our elective body.
Touché, Madam Joyce. Yeah, look, I guess, you know, on certain fundamental powers of Congress, I think it's problematic. Look, this is one of the reasons why you and I have discussed many times. Over the years, as the decades have gone by, Congress has kind of ceded a bit of power to the executive branch. And partly it's because of this. Because for short-term, nearsighted partisan interests, there are subsections of Congress who from time to time don't assert themselves. And this would be an opportunity for Congress as a body, not as a divided Democrat versus Republican Congress, but as a body, to assert its privileges and assert its authorities, one of which being the ability to conduct an investigation and hold people accountable if they defy the subpoenas of a duly constituted committee, which is what happened here. And it shouldn't actually be, you know, in the abstract, a partisan issue. Congress has the authority. It should use the authority. And when the Republicans are in power, they can use the authority. When the Democrats are in power, they can. And but the ultimate effect of all of this over time is a diminution of power in Congress, which gets granted over time to the presidency. You agree with that?
Yeah, I do. And I suppose it's going to be up to historians to debate whether that's for political motivation or just because we've managed to elect people to Congress who don't fully understand our system of government and how it's supposed to work. But I confess, and maybe this just happens as you age, I feel a little bit of sentimentality towards those days when people who did not agree on policy issues. And I mean, I'm thinking about people like John McCain, of whom I was not a huge fan on policy grounds, but who I thought was a good human in many regards. And this notion that people would reach out across the aisle, right? The Teddy Kennedys of the Senate, who would reach out across to preserve the institution. That seems a little bit fanciful in this day and age to expect that to happen. And maybe that means we're jaded and our politics are cynical. But in large part, that is the problem that we face that we're going to have to solve if we're going to continue to have a three-branch system of government.
Yeah, look, but there's some bipartisanship here. Among the nine House Republicans who voted in favor of holding Bannon in contempt or referring for criminal contempt was dyed-in-the-wool liberal Liz Cheney, who has been named the vice chair of the committee. And what I thought was interesting about her statement with respect to the vote is, as we talked about last week or the week before, one of the arguments that the Trump folks are making in the assertion of privilege is a related point. That is, Congress has no ability to conduct an investigation unless they have a clear legislative purpose. And their argument about what a legislative purpose is it bears somehow on their lawmaking ability. You know, what laws might they repeal? What laws might they enact? What laws might they amend in connection with anything that they do? Some folks have a different idea, don't think it's such a stark requirement. But Liz Cheney, unlike some other folks who have spoken, I don't know that Benny Thompson made this point himself. I haven't scrutinized every single one of his statements, but Liz Cheney made a point to give, you know, specific examples of legislative purposes that attach to the investigation. Why do you think she did that?
I think she did that because it's important to enforcing subpoenas to show that your investigation is legitimate. And look, I'm a fan of what she's doing here, right? I think it's possible for Congress to legitimately do things that go beyond changing laws. But changing laws, looking at the need for new laws, that's a core function for Congress when it engages in this sort of work. And so to the extent that she's got these four highly specific sorts of rationales for the work that they're doing, I think she puts anyone who wants to try to evade a subpoena into a box that it's very hard for them to get out of. You know, leave aside all the hypocrisy and the Benghazi stuff. Congress really does have a core mission here after January 6th. They need to figure out how it happened, make sure that they strengthened the defenses both of Congress and of the country to try to keep it from happening again. And so, for instance, she starts out by implicating the 1887 Electoral Count Act and thinking about whether that needs to be updated. And certainly the Eastman memo, which we've discussed on the podcast a couple of times, implicates that sort of notion of whether our processes for confirming an election's results are up to date. Very legitimate for Congress to subpoena people and inquire into their conduct in that regard, right?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of put all these arguments that she's making and that others could make into the category of, you know, there ought to be a law. How do you figure out whether or not there ought to be a law? You got to look at what went wrong, because ultimately, whatever laws were in place, one could argue they failed to protect the Capitol. They failed to protect the integrity of the process, or almost failed ultimately in making sure that the person who rightly won the election was installed in the White House. And when you have something that untoward and that dangerous and that radical come close to fruition, how can it be that that does not implicate the legislative function and what kinds of laws need to be passed. I mean, what's interesting also is, do you think she could have said also that this investigation with respect to 1/6 and the connected issue of the big lie and people's abilities to have their votes count in various states, that she could have also said one legislative purpose of this is to give some grist to voting rights legislation as well. And she didn't include that.
Well, then she wouldn't be Liz Cheney if she had said that. But, you know, I think it really is important because what many people seem to want is something Congress can't deliver here, right? Congress, they're not running a criminal investigation. There won't be indictments at the end of whatever work Congress does. Congress needs to make sure that it stays in its constitutional lane here. That's more important now than ever. And so having these four, you know, this is probably as far as Liz Cheney can go working with the Democrats, and we should respect and appreciate that. Asking her to engage on voting rights, wow, Preet, that would really be stepping into the breach.
So then, you know, the question that we've been asking ourselves and that we get asked every week, now that it's gone to the Justice Department, what is Merrick Garland going to do? And I guess before we get to what the answer to that is, how long do you think it'll take? My sense is it's not that complicated. It's not, you know, a highly complex financial transaction case or international terrorism plot or cyber hack of some sort. It's the simple matter of the resolution passed, the referral has been made, the subpoena was issued, Bannon has defied it. There seems to be no legitimate claim of executive privilege here. Indict or not indict, first question for you is, how long do you think it'll take?
You know, my crystal ball really sucks in this regard. It took DOJ 9 days in 1983 to indict Rita Lavelle, then the head of EPA. I don't think DOJ could do anything in 9 days. I mean, it's just,
we used to do stuff in 9 days, my friend.
We've gotten slower, especially on something like this, where it has to go through different layers of supervision. I just question whether that capacity exists. But as you point out, the decision could have been made, could have been in the works before they received the referral. That would have been the right way to do things. Communication between folks in the D.C. U.S. Attorney's Office and folks in Maine Justice. It's not a tough case. Either you're going to indict it or you're going to invoke that part of the federal principles of prosecution that says, you know, if there's a non-criminal approach that would be better, then you should decline prosecution and let that go ahead. I mean, I hope that they won't do this. I think folks at DOJ might say, well, since criminal prosecution won't guarantee Congress Bannon's testimony, we think it would be better for Congress to go ahead and use a civil lawsuit to try to force him to testify. I think that would be the wrong approach here, but it could take them some time to work those issues out. In other words, I'm ducking your question. I don't really have a number of days.
Yes, but I think you and I agree that we're talking about days or weeks, not months.
I think that's right. If this lingers on much past the 2-week mark, there's something wrong.
Yeah, you know, I hate to predict on these kinds of things. I get this wrong on a regular basis also. I just feel like, as you and I have said before, if there was a case in which criminal contempt of Congress seemed appropriate, it's this one. Especially because a lot of these other folks, including Jeffrey Clark, who we'll come to, are coming and appearing before Congress, and they were in the executive branch at the time that the communications that are being inquired about took place. So Steve Bannon is being defiant and stubborn, and there has to be some accountability for that. So I think on balance, a case will be brought. If a case is not brought, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but Merrick Garland and DOJ are going to face a torrent of criticism, will they not?
They will, and rightfully so. I mean, look, you know like I do, though, the deal at DOJ is you make the decision you believe is the right one, and you're willing to face that torrent of criticism. But something that we've said a lot that bears repeating in this regard is everything about January 6th is unique. It's monumental. It has impact for the future. If you're ever going to exercise your prosecutorial discretion in a case like this to enforce a congressional subpoena, this is the one. Bannon didn't try to negotiate in good faith. He didn't, for instance, show up for the hearing because there are questions that he could be asked that would clearly not be covered by executive privilege. So he didn't go through that process of one by one answering or declining to answer questions based on privilege. He just sort of thumbed his nose at Congress. And the criticism DOJ will face if they don't intervene, I think, is righteous criticism.
Yeah, I mean, we keep talking about how he's defied the subpoena. I think you make a very important and often overlooked point that even if you're going to make the argument that some executive privilege applies, which I think is baseless, you can't say that every single thing about which you could be asked a question, like why were you at the Willard Hotel or how many days were you in town, you know, stuff that's just fact-based and doesn't have anything to do with the communication or any interaction with the former president, how do you blithely and brazenly say you're not going to answer any of that? You're just not going to appear. So I agree with you. Now,
and can I just say there's another distinction here that we haven't really talked about, which is between conducting the business of the presidency and conducting a campaign. And a lot of the questions Congress has are about conduct of a campaign. No possible argument that those are covered by executive power. I mean, that's beyond specious. I've run out of hyperbole. But that particularly has to be enforced.
Yeah, 100%. Now, there was something of a controversy last week that I wrote about, because I think it's interesting on the part of some people who will brook no criticism about Joe Biden. And Biden was asked by Caitlin Collins at CNN, I think 8 or 9 days ago, about what should happen to folks who defy the committee subpoenas, whether they should be charged. And he said,
I hope that the committee goes after them and holds them accountable.
Should they be prosecuted by the Justice Department?
I do, yes.
And I think you criticized that. I criticized that. Barb McQuaid, a lot of people did.
Yes.
Because it suggests in a way that the people who are from the department, and I think every right-thinking person, that there's a little bit of pressure being brought to bear on a particular prosecution by the sitting president of the United States, and that's not a great thing. And the Department of Justice had a very strong reaction where they said, the Department of Justice will make its own independent decisions in all prosecutions based solely on the facts and the law, period, full stop. And when I pointed it out, and when Barb pointed it out, and some others did, you know, there are a lot of folks saying, no, you're being ridiculous, it was totally appropriate. It's not. It was not appropriate.
No, it's not appropriate.
And you know how we know it's not appropriate? Biden himself, in the last few days, said this, quote, the way I said it was not appropriate. I should have chosen my words more wisely. I did not, have not, and will not pick up the phone and call the attorney general and tell him what he should or should not do in terms of who he should prosecute, end quote. Case closed, right?
I thought that that was really great. I'm not sure. I mean, it's mostly case closed with a little coda. In the piece that you wrote for Cafe, I thought you got it exactly right. You said at this time and in this country, it was a mistake and he shouldn't have said it because it gave that appearance of giving direction to DOJ. Anybody who's ever worked inside of DOJ understands that it has no impact on decision-making at DOJ. The president misspoke, right? Like all of us, he has personal views on the issue. But in context, he should have kept those personal views to himself. And I hope that this is just a sort of a cautionary tale for him on the virtue of not even speculating on what he thinks DOJ should do on a specific criminal case as opposed to on policy where there's a wide scope for the White House and DOJ to work together.
Yeah, look, I think it's important, as we always discuss, and I like to always emphasize, there's a difference between good faith criticism and argument and bad faith criticism and argument. And the people who said what you and I said about the Biden remark, I think are clearly acting in good faith. I support Joe Biden. I think he's a million times better for the rule of law and for legal norms and a million other things than Donald Trump. But when he strays, we should talk about it. And, you know, I think he thought better of it and he apologized for it and made clear that he didn't mean what he said. And we should say it. But I understand the frustration on the part of folks who worry that when there's criticism of Biden, there's a false equivalency, as I wrote about. There's no comparison between this remark by Joe Biden and the scores of things, the actions taken by the former president to weaponize the Department of Justice. But just because there's no equivalency between those two things doesn't mean that Joe Biden or someone you support gets a buy on every single thing.
Absolutely. I'm 100% on that. I mean, when some of our friends were rejoining DOJ, the conversation that we had was, congratulations, and I look forward to criticizing all of your mistakes, right? Because, I mean, that's what we do. I thought, Preet, you did a great job on this. I thought Jen Psaki, in the press conference, did a great job. She said, Well, since you give me the opportunity, she was asked about whether Biden was doing the same stuff that Trump did. She says, since you give me the opportunity here, former President Trump used his office to incite an insurrection. He put political pressure on senior DOJ officials to propagate lies about the election to the point where they threatened to resign en masse. I think there's hardly a comparison here. She sort of nailed that, right?
She did. She did. Because it's bad faith. People are trying to, not in good faith, criticize Biden, but somehow accuse good faith people of hypocrisy or trying to rehabilitate Trump in some way and say, look, your guy's just like my guy. Not true. They're different guys.
If Biden wanted DOJ to do his bidding, he would not have picked Merrick Garland to be his attorney general. Garland has shown a lot of independence, like it or not.
You know what else he would have done?
What?
He would have replaced the U.S. attorney who's investigating his son.
No kidding,
I mean,
right?
Give me a break.
A Republican U.S. attorney still sitting there running the Hunter Biden
investigation. That guy has his job still, unlike others, because Biden and his team were aware of the optics of replacing a U.S. attorney who is investigating his own son, Hunter. So, look, it was a mistake. He admitted it. We're all the better for it. The department is the better for it. Public confidence in decisions by the department is better for it. I think we can move on. We mentioned Jeffrey Clark a few minutes ago. So that dude is coming before the committee, I think on October 29th. So it won't be Halloween, so he won't be in costume. How interesting. I want to remind people who Jeffrey Clark is and the degree of villainy that should be ascribed to him and if that's going to be important in your mind.
So Jeffrey Clark was the head of the Environment and Natural Resources Division at DOJ, and he became at some point the acting head of the Civil Division. I don't know about you, Preet, but I don't think that's sort of the level at DOJ where you have independent engagement with the White House, let alone with the president. But somehow this, you know, this dude just ends up at the White House talking with Trump about how do you overthrow a lawful election. And so he's involved in all of these shenanigans in meetings with Acting Attorney General Jeff Rosen, where essentially, as everyone will remember, the offer is, hey, Rosen, I won't take your job, the job that the president is now offering to put me into, as long as you'll go along with this scheme to try to overturn the election in states like Georgia. And of course, Rosen declined to do that. And so that's how we end up where we are in this regard. Clark comes in to testify on Friday. I don't know. I assume he's not testifying publicly, right?
I think all these folks are coming in initially, like happened in the first impeachment proceeding, for depositions. And then at some point, we'll see some public testimony. Depending.
Staff interviews first.
Yeah, or maybe with members. Actually, I'm not clear on that.
I mean, this is an opportunity, and I'm sure that we will hear the results pretty quickly, to figure out what the approach is going to be. Is he still a staunch defender of the president? Is he going to come in and, you know, maybe assert some executive privilege and refuse to give up any substantive information? Is he maybe going to take middle ground and try to save his own name and tell his story and defend himself? Or could we possibly be in for a John Dean moment? We haven't seen any of that from folks inside of the Trump inner circle, and it feels like we're overdue if we're ever going to make progress on this.
You think he's going to be capable of a John Dean moment?
No, I really don't.
By that you mean a moment in which
telling the truth
comes clean,
right?
And tells the truth, yeah.
Yeah. How refreshing if someone would actually say, look, here's what was going on, and then good, bad, or indifferent lay out what actually went on as Trump became increasingly frantic after the election when his efforts to try to mitigate some of the state results failed and what happened in the lead into January 6th?
Look, I don't mean to shock and upset anyone, but Jeff Clark may want to maintain his ability to become the actual attorney general in the next Trump administration, right?
I mean, that could be what happens here. On the other hand, you know, John Dean has had some success in life based on being willing to bite the bullet. But like you say, no reason to believe Jeffrey Clark is capable of that.
So there's this other reporting, you know, more facts keep coming out months after the event, that essentially there were a number of Trump supporters and advisors who basically built a command center. They called it, they themselves called it a command center, a set of rooms and suites at the Willard Hotel, just a block from the White House.
I always build my war rooms at the most expensive hotel in D.C.
I don't think the Willard is the most expensive, but it's
yeah,
nice.
Yeah, that's true. Not anymore.
It's nice. And they were plotting and planning in the days leading up to January 6th and stayed for days after January 6th, billing the rooms to the Trump campaign. Apparently, rooms for his associates ran up a bill of over $55,000, which is a lot of money.
The RNC refused to pay the bill, right? They finally had to go to the Trump campaign to get it covered.
Yeah, so, you know, I think we're getting a better picture of who was plotting with whom and at, you know, over what period of time. We already know that one of the reasons they want to talk to Steve Bannon is because he was saying things, very dramatic things, not in the days leading up to January 6th, but the day before January 6th, about how this was going to be different. A lot was going to happen, using bellicose language. And now we know about the command center. Does that have any legal significance?
Yeah, I think it does. The only objection that Bannon has filed for compliance with the subpoena is executive privilege. There's no executive privilege in campaign activity, and this is clearly, at best, campaign activity. It's an interesting foursome, right? Sort of the four horsemen of the apocalypse at the Willard. What do you make of Bernard Carrick's presence? He had been an outlier in Trump circles, but he has a real checkered background.
Yeah, you know, Bernard Carrick was, people may not remember, he was the commissioner of the NYPD, the New York Police Department, some years ago, confidant of Rudy Giuliani. When I took over as U.S. attorney, there was a case, criminal case pending against Bernie Carrick, indicted by the Southern District on a number of counts, including, I think, making false statements and tax evasion. He had been nominated to be the Secretary of Homeland Security. That fell apart. And instead of getting that, he got indicted, went to prison. He's now become, it's interesting to see this, you know, former police commissioner, hard-nosed and hard-line, pro-law enforcement guy, is now, you know, a big talker about prison reform and criminal justice reform, because now he knows what it's like to be prosecuted. His background and track record speak for themselves. I guess that's all I'm going to say about Bernie Carrick.
I think that's right. I mean, I think it's interesting that he's there, and it's so interesting that these three, Giuliani, Bannon, and Carrick, are in proximity to John Eastman, who's, of course, the architect of the roadmap to insurrection, the legal path to overturning the election, and that he even tried to distance himself from his plan. In the National Review, he sort of says, well, I never really thought that this was realistic. I mean, come on, dude, you were in the war room.
Yeah, the Eastman piece is interesting because he's trying to save his hide and reputation now, and he shouldn't be able to get away with that.
Well, maybe he'll be the John Dean out of hopes he has some sort of resurrection. I'm not usually this optimistic, but I really do feel like we're ripe to get somebody who's going to decide, maybe even just to save their own skin, that the American people deserve the truth.
Moving from the insurrection to abortion law. People have been following, I trust, the continuing saga over this law in Texas, SB 8. And there are, you know, it gets complicated, and hopefully we've broken it down in a somewhat simplified way. But the most recent thing that's happened that's very significant is the Supreme Court has now granted cert, meaning they agree to hear the case. And they've done so in a circumstance in which there's no final judgment in the court below. How common is it for cert, what lawyers call cert, certiorari, to be granted before judgment?
It's really rare. It's only happened a handful of times. It mostly happens when the Justice Department asks for it. And of course, you can understand why. It's a lot more difficult for the court. Sometimes they do it in companion cases. And at the risk of being a little bit legally nerdy here, I'll just use this example. When, I guess right before we became U.S. attorneys, federal sentencing guidelines ran into a little bit of constitutional trouble. And the Supreme Court, when it got to that ruling, actually pulled a case up from the lower courts at DOJ's request so that they could squarely consider two cases that raised the issue of whether federal judges could sentence on the basis of facts that they found existed as opposed to facts that juries found existed when they delivered a verdict. So it's typically in cases like that that pose weighty, pressing questions where you're trying to get all of the factual scenarios in front of you that you need to resolve an issue. A lot of people predicted that there would be certiorari before the judgment here. I was surprised, to be honest.
What's also interesting is, you know, how they dealt with the status quo. what they felt the status quo should be.
Yeah.
So it's one thing to say we're going to grant cert and we're going to hear the case. And I think argument is set for November 1st, which is not far away. It's very soon. And briefing has to be concluded before then. But while agreeing to hear the case, they didn't enjoin SB 8. SB 8, the law that chills abortion in Texas, remains valid law. And Justice Sotomayor, and we should talk about her dissent in part, takes great issue with the fact that abortion has been chilled and there's a run on nearby states for people who are seeking abortion services as an urgent matter. I'm in agreement with her that while you're thinking about this, you should not leave in place a law that you and I have discussed many times clearly violates the current precedents of the United States Supreme Court, including Roe v. Wade.
She writes with such a clear bell-like voice, increasingly in dissent on these issues. You know, the standard for granting certiorari before judgment is whether the case is of such imperative public importance as to justify deviation from normal appellate practice. In other words, it only really makes sense to grant certiorari in this case if your plan, as the Supreme Court, is to smack Texas for writing such a ridiculous statute that so clearly violates rights. And so the fact that the court grants it, but at the same time refuses to enjoin SB 8, continues to allow Texas to deprive women of their constitutional rights. It's a weird sort of mixed messaging from the court, or maybe it's not weird. Maybe it just obviously leads to the result that we're headed into.
I'm going to ask you your prediction again, but it's not looking good for people who are in support of abortion rights. Look, Justice Sotomayor, as you say, writes very clearly about this, and she makes it very immediate and concrete. She writes, quote, "There are women in Texas who became pregnant on or around the day that SB 8 took effect. As I write these words, some of those women do not know they are pregnant. When they find out, should they wish to exercise their constitutional right to seek abortion care, they will be unable to do so anywhere in their home state," end quote. That brings home how stark a reality this is. It's not just sort of a legal abstract issue that the court can decide at its leisure, but it has an immediate effect today, tomorrow, the next day, until this thing is resolved.
And we know what the state of Texas will say in response to that, because they've already said it in their briefs. They've essentially said the federal government and abortion providers aren't entitled to demand that Texas write its laws to permit them to be challenged. In other words, Texas says, you know, we don't care. We don't care about these women, these people, their constitutional rights. If we can craftily write a statute using vigilante justice to avoid review, it is open season. I expect Justice Sotomayor is going to make a mockery of them in oral argument. I mean, I really hope she'll unleash. Somebody needs to. Because when you look at this case, it's really sort of crazy, right? The Supreme Court will not, at least not explicitly, consider the constitutionality of SB 8 in this case that they've agreed to hear on November 1st. I think they sort of implicitly have to reach it, although I'm also a minority view in that regard. But the issues that they're going to hear are whether or not DOJ has standing to sue the state of Texas and Texas officials directly. There's a quasi-sovereign immunity issue there. And then for the abortion providers, for that case, they're going to take up consideration of whether the vigilante justice scheme can pass muster. And it seems to me that this is really crazy because, you know, courts like to decide cases on the easiest, narrowest basis possible. And that easy, narrow basis here is that Roe versus Wade and its progeny create a right to pre-viability abortion. End of story. The court doesn't need to look at anything else. They can simply say, following Roe versus Wade, Texas law is unconstitutional. Game over. And the fact that they're unwilling to do that, I think, is really disturbing. You don't have to be very good at reading the tea leaves to see where this is headed.
Yeah, look, the other point on a more concrete level that Justice Sotomayor makes, I think, is an important one, because one of the things that Texas folks say is, well, you can go elsewhere. You can leave Texas and have an abortion. And she says there's all this evidence that the act has had a stunning and crushing impact on clinics in surrounding states. She points out, quote, "An Oklahoma provider, for example, reported a staggering 646% increase of Texan patients per day, occupying between 50% and 75% of capacity," end quote. So This is real stuff. It's happening right now.
And that's the value of having a record in the court below. The first time the Supreme Court considered SB 8, it was on the shadow docket with no record. This time, as these issues come up, we have this 100-page plus opinion from the district judge in Texas, and he gave Justice Sotomayor the factual basis in the record because he meticulously went through the evidence and talked about the impact on out-of-state clinics and Texas women so that she could then issue this ruling. I mean, that in many ways, I think, speaks to the importance of going through the process, which can take a little bit of time, and building an appropriate record in the lower courts. Brunswick, Georgia is a small city. The metro area has about 119,000 residents on the coast in Georgia. It's about halfway between Savannah, Georgia and Jacksonville, Florida. It's a small town. Brunswick itself is majority Black, but the outlying area is sort of predictably suburban with a large white population. And so this, as many of you will have already heard, but as we're beginning to become more familiar with because jury selection is now underway, this is a really horrific crime. A Black man named Ahmaud Arbery is out jogging. Two men, father and son team, Travis McMichael and his dad, Gregory McMichael. Gregory McMichael is a former recently retired police officer who also worked in the district attorney's office. They, for some reason, decide that Arbery is responsible for a string of burglaries that have been taking place in their neighborhood. So they lock and load. They take their guns with them. Dad has a .357, and Travis has a shotgun. And they go off after Ahmaud Arbery, and they ultimately confront him, and they shoot and kill him. And what happens next is astonishing. It takes 4 months, a New York Times article, and the release of video for this to be perceived as the crime.
Where did the video come from? Remind people where the video came from.
So it's really interesting. There's actually now a third defendant in this situation, a man named William Roddy Bryan. And he hooks up with the McMichaels and follows along with them, and he's videotaping everything as it occurs. And it's that videotape that ultimately surfaces. This videotape clearly portrays stuff that the McMichaels didn't see in this situation. They almost thought that they were sort of like gangster celebrities, right? They were out enforcing vigilante justice of their own. Interesting. There's no suggestion, by the way, that there was any sort of criminal conduct during this run. Arbery goes into a home that's under construction. My husband does that all the time, right? He's inextricably pulled into these construction sites and loves to sort of check it out. A lot of people do that. There's no burglary, there's no crime. But last time I checked, Preet, I don't think that there's a death penalty for the crime of attempted burglary, even if that's what you think is going on here.
I think you made clear that Arbery was completely unarmed. Now, the McMichaels suggest in defense of themselves that he was reaching inside his clothing, but no weapon, no knife, no gun. He was essentially gunned down in cold blood while he was jogging.
I mean, that's what this situation is. And to add to the situation, so here's where we now are. There's a state indictment. There's a federal indictment. And there's an indictment of a prosecutor for obstructing justice and violating her oath of office. You don't see that very often, do you?
No. But just before we get to that, you know, one other thing that might have emboldened the people who did the killing here is that Georgia had a citizen's arrest law that maybe a former cop thought, I can remain a cop even in retirement, and I know how to do this, and I have a weapon, and I'm sort of, you know, a citizen police. One consequence of the publicity surrounding this crime is that that citizen's arrest law was repealed in Georgia, and a hate crime statute was enacted in Georgia. And as you say, I mean, as people should understand, if you enact a law after the conduct of a defendant, you can't charge that person with breaking that law. And DOJ decided to come in and bring its own independent hate crime prosecution. As for the last point, you know, we should talk about the law under which the original, one of the original district attorneys was charged. It's basically a statute in Georgia that makes violating your oath of office, willfully violating your oath of office, a crime, and it carries a pretty stiff penalty, as you and I were discussing before we started taping. There's actually a mandatory minimum sentence of a year in prison, up to a maximum of 5 years in prison. We haven't undertaken a comprehensive search. I think that's an unusual law. Some people will applaud it. Some people will say it's overbroad. But it's an interesting law and an interesting application of it, applying it to a district attorney for engaging in what is clearly, at a minimum, unethical conduct, right?
Yeah, I mean, the statute prohibits willfully and intentionally violating the terms of your oath of office. So I think that that has to mean it's not casual, it's not a mistake, but you intend to violate your oath of office. So maybe that application to a situation where, if the facts that are alleged here, which is that the district attorney took affirmative steps to insulate the McMichaels from prosecution, perhaps it's a good fit here. I mean, it's an interesting notion, right? Prosecuting people for violating their oath of office, maybe leading back to our first topic. But I think you're right. This is not, I don't recall ever seeing a prosecution for a crime like this before.
The circumstances are very egregious, and the crime's particularly heinous. And you have this interconnection of private citizen, former cop, sitting district attorneys, overlapping conflicts. And, you know, you have the video that speaks very powerfully. You know, it seems like, again and again, it's the video that becomes important, taken by a bystander. Here, obviously, it's not a bystander. It's someone who actually essentially participated in the crime, is charged in connection with the crime with felony murder. But without the video, I don't know how this case would have gone.
There are two kinds of murder charges in the state case. One is malice murder. That's what we commonly understand as intentional murder. It's not premeditated murder. It's a step-down sort of classification that you intended the results of your actions. But there are also felony murder charges here, and that means a murder that happens during the commission of another felony. So there are two felonies that are charged in the state case. One is aggravated assault based on the use of both the weapons and the vehicles, some big trucks that these guys were driving around when they cornered their victim. But also there's a charge related to what I view as a form of kidnapping. It's a felony charge that Arbery was constrained from moving away by these defendants before they killed him. So they have these two interesting possible theories that the state will use here to argue for felony murder, which carries serious consequences without the need to prove intent to kill.
Right. Good summary. In any event, we'll be following the case. Jury selection is underway. I was surprised a little bit. Maybe shouldn't be surprising given the size of the community. According to reporting, how many potential jurors know either the victim or one of the defendants? And that, you know, generally speaking, poses an obstacle. So they're going through a number of people to finally get a final jury that the judge has confidence will be neutral and fair-minded. So, you know, one subject, Joyce, that we did not get to today, and I think we'll be talking about in the coming weeks, is the increasing pressure on Facebook. Are you familiar with the Facebook?
You mean the nation state of Facebook?
The nation state of Facebook. All these leaked emails are suggesting, among other things, that, you know, executives at Facebook knew the impact they were having on young people, on elections, on the dissemination of misinformation in campaigns. Also, lots of people within the company were upset at how the company was behaving. So it's making a lot of waves. A lot of people are calling for accountability. A lot of people are very critical. My colleague, Kara Swisher, has had a lot to say about it. Professor Galloway. But we learned in recent days that Facebook is considering, or I guess is planning, to change its name, which has led to jokes.
Well, isn't that what everybody does, right? When you're exposed for throwing gasoline onto the fire, you just rebrand.
Yeah. I mean, it's a little hard when you're a global nation state sort of change your name. I guess it's possible. But it has led to some jokes by the professional joke people, some of which were compiled by New York Times journalist Trish Bendix, who offered some possibilities for the name change.
So among our favorites is Trevor Noah. Look, I am no Trevor Noah, though. I mean, I'm almost scared. I'm not going to even try to read in his voice because he's so hysterically funny. And as my children remind me every night at the dinner table when I try to retell a joke, Mom, you're not funny. But
weird.
Here's Trevor Noah. He says, I'm excited to find out what the new name is going to be. Like, you know, maybe they'll go with MySpace. I mean, they already took everything else from them. Might as well finish the job.
Stephen Colbert said this kind of poignant. Look, they're still facing accusations of endangering teens, spreading misinformation, and destroying democracy. So they're doing the right thing, rebranding the company with a new name. So,
Trevor Noah again says, I don't know if this is a good idea. I mean, Facebook is one of those iconic brands like Hiroshima and Ted Bundy. Do you really want to lose that name recognition?
And then here's Stephen Colbert offering potential names. Just in case they haven't settled on one yet, we here at The Late Show have come up with a few appropriate names, like Pinsurrectionist, Aunt Brenda's three-paragraph rantatorium, Best Fun Times America website, and the Washington football team. By the way,
maybe they'll just stick with Facebook.
You know, the company that I remember very famously changed its name, I don't know if it had any effect, was Philip Morris, Big Tobacco, changed its name to Altria. Changed everything, right?
How appropriate comparing Facebook to Big Tobacco.
So we'll be back next week to talk about Facebook and what's happening there, the insurrection, abortion law, and, you know, whatever else is going on. Send us your questions to letters@cafe.com.
We'll do our best to answer them.
That's it for this week. Cafe Insider is presented by Cafe Studios and the Vox Media Podcast Network. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Joyce Vance. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The technical director is David Tatasciore. The senior producers are Adam Waller and Matthew Billy. And the Cafe team is David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, Chelsea Simmons, and Namita Shah. Our music is by Andrew Doss. Thank you for being a part of the Cafe Insider community.